Chapter 1. Canada, 1937. The year was 1937, and it was late summer in Canada. The economic effects of America's Great Depression were being felt far and wide as hundreds of companies shuttered their doors and gainful employment was impossible to find. Over the previous few months, two news stories had captivated the public's attention. In May, the hydrogen-filled Hindenburg exploded as it attempted to moor in New Jersey, a spectacular conflagration caught on film and played throughout movie theaters across the country. Just months later, another aviation incident kept families glued to their radios as world-famous pilot Amelia Earhart disappeared in the Pacific Ocean during her attempt to circle the globe. 200 miles north of Toronto, cars were lined up along the side of the highway near the small town of Callander. Scores of families were filling their tanks one more time before heading into the rural farmland, anxious to satisfy an entirely different obsession. With names like Baby View Pavilion, tourist camps and cabins had sprung up everywhere. The Red Line Inn had added an extra story to accommodate the summer swarms. Even the Callander gas station had capitalized on the tourist fascination by installing 5 gas pumps directly by the road, each one labeled Cecile, Yvonne, Annette, Marie, and Emily. Children in the family car no doubt had their favorite and would quarrel over which pump they would use. Many had traveled from the furthest reaches of the United States to make that last right turn in Callander towards what only 3 years earlier had been a ramshackle farm in the middle of nowhere. Now, it was completely transformed, the epicenter of a craze that had captured the hearts and hopes of people across the globe. In 1934, a Canadian woman had given birth to 5 baby girls. They weren't the first quintuplets ever born, but with North America mired in economic distress, the story of the Dions, a poor family living with no electricity, gas, or running water, and their 5 tiny girls as they fought for their lives, lit the world on fire. A full set of quintuplets had never made it longer than 50 days, and the doctor who helped deliver them offered little hope they would survive, a pronouncement which only emboldened the thousands who furiously cycled through their rosaries, praying diligently for the girls' well-being. Together, the infants tipped the scales at 13 pounds, their individual weights unknown, as nurses couldn't locate anything small enough to accurately measure them. They were placed in laundry baskets, swaddled with blankets warmed from the wood fire stove. Extra nurses were on call 24 hours a day, stroking their fragile bodies with olive oil, coaxing them along whenever their breathing appeared to falter. As day 50 approached, all of the tiny infants had begun to show their grit. They had put on weight, a statistic tracked daily in newspapers across the continent. "Quintuplets lose a bit," the June 16th New York Times declared, only to proclaim, "Quintuplets hold gain," the next day. The world watched breathlessly as they consumed any and all news regarding the girls' skin color, their feeding schedule, and even the Lilliputian clothing being knitted by impromptu volunteers. Well-wishers began to show up at the Dion farm in hopes of catching a glimpse of the babes, but were left to gape at 100 diapers drying along 3 different clotheslines. Their father erected a fence to keep nosy onlookers at bay, later topped it with barbed wire, then finally called in for assistance from the local police to maintain order. The nurses could not help but to appease the crowds that would gather outside, many of whom who had brought donations of clothing, bedding, and even donated breast milk, all in hopes of playing a small part in the girls' survival. Once or twice a day, a nurse might walk out onto the porch and hold one of the tiny infants aloft, displaying their name for everyone to see on a large placard affixed to the railing. "Yvonne!" the crowd would cry out, responding to any sign of life with coos and cries of delight as the nurse slowly rotated the baby in the air for a more thorough observation. The nurse would return inside for a moment, change the sign to a different girl's name, and return with the same baby. "Marie!" the applauding throng would call out in an attempt to cajole the girl into some sort of reaction. Early on, even the nurses had difficulty telling them apart and came to rely on their weights for differentiation. From behind the fence, the men, women, and children had no idea who they'd actually seen, but it didn't matter. They could return home and tell their friends they had traveled all the way past Callander, Canada, and seen firsthand the Dion quintuplets. With their notoriety growing, the Canadian government determined that the parents were incapable of properly raising the girls and assumed their guardianship. Directly across the road from the home where they were born, a small nursery and hospital were constructed, surrounded by two barbed wire fences. Here the Quints would eat and sleep, raised by several full-time nurses and the doctor who had helped deliver them. Within a few years, crowds had begun to grow so large, a huge observation gallery was constructed, a playground surrounded on three sides by a building from which curious sightseers could observe the girls' activities through a one-way viewing screen. A full-time police sentry building was constructed, along with a restaurant and an enormous souvenir shop. Thousands of people would cycle through the area every day during the warm summer months, eager to catch a glimpse of the girls at play. Quintland, as it came to be called, became a national attraction, the pride of Canada. Millions of dollars began pouring into the local and regional economies. Postcards, dinner plates, baby dolls, and collectible spoons were but a few of the items anyone might buy, each made in sets of five: Cecile, Yvonne, Annette, Marie, and Emily. The girls appeared to have beaten the odds. They had survived infancy and were pronounced by their doctor to be in perfect health. The importance of their sound condition could not have been more important. Their doctor had become an international celebrity and was traveling to points far and wide where packed theaters full of inquisitive physicians hung on every word as he recounted the techniques he had employed to ensure their survival. While the remarkable story warmed the hearts of millions, behind the scenes, a shadow had appeared. Marie, by far the tiniest and most frail, had been able to catch up with the others, but unfortunately, Emily, the mischievous one, had started having fainting spells. She had been prone to sickness more than her sisters, but this new development troubled both caretakers and parents. As the world followed the girls' lives and marveled at their doctor's miraculous handiwork, it was decided the veneer of perfect health would be maintained at all costs. Not a word of Emily's troubles would be mentioned outside the iron fences of the nursery, for now. As cars topped off their tanks from the gas pumps named Marie or Cecile and made the turn for Quintland, another family rode in their car, silently, towards a much different destination. They had left their home in Forest City, Mississippi, and were headed south to a preventorium, a special facility originally designed to isolate people with tuberculosis, a respiratory infection often caused by highly contagious bacteria. This campus housed children exclusively, but was today receiving a different kind of patient. A boy, not with tuberculosis, but something unlike anything they had ever seen before. Like the Dion quintuplets, Donald Triplett's caretakers had made efforts to hide his differences from the public. His father, a prominent attorney, and mother, a busy socialite and teacher, were concerned with the appearances of having a disturbed son. Mental problems were widely believed to be inherited, and as a result, the stigma of having such a child reflected poorly on their genetic stock. If word spread of Donald's issues, their social standing might have been wrecked, and any of their future children would likely have difficulties finding someone willing to marry them. Donald was born in September 1933 and seemed completely normal. He walked and talked at the expected times, hit all of his development milestones, some earlier than usual. Then something changed. He stopped responding when his parents called his name. He no longer made direct eye contact with anyone. He appeared to desire little human interaction at all, but preferred the company of inanimate objects, paperclips, ashtrays. Donald was able to latch onto the world's fascination with the Dion quintuplets and had memorized their names. But in another curious development, he associated them not with the girls themselves, but with colors. Annette, to him, represented blue, while Cecile was red. "Annette and Cecile make purple," he might say, as he learned to combine colors to make new ones while he painted. Other word transpositions would follow, such as switching I for you and vice versa. For his mother, whose main concern for her child might have been tuberculosis or summer diarrhea, this was a maddening development. Every health precaution had been taken, disease had been avoided, and yet something very strange had happened to her son. He had disappeared. His body was there, but it were as if a crucial part of his being vanished into thin air. In complete despair, and due to exhortations from their doctors, Donald's parents had agreed to institutionalize him. They were dropping him off at the Preventorium to be taken care of by professionals, an expense most would not have been able to afford. His parents were instructed to get on with their lives, have more children, and do their best to forget Donald had ever happened. The farewell, like every other goodbye since they'd lost him, was non-existent. In what might have been the most hurtful phenomenon of all, Donald left their presence into the company of strangers without the least complaint. The years of struggle his mother had invested provided few rewards. A slight pause or turn, a teary eye, anything that would indicate he was alarmed at her departure might have caused her to reconsider leaving him. But as he was led away by a nurse toward his room, there was nothing. He walked away from her as if they had never met. While Donald and Emily were thousands of miles apart, they may have shared a much deeper connection than a reference to color. Although both of their mothers would have been concerned with tuberculosis and summer diarrhea, another disease, not often mentioned today, would have stoked the majority of their fear. A bacterial infection, unheard of in the United States before the mid-1800s, had become a horrible killer, taking the lives of countless children every year. A crude vaccine had existed for several decades, but its side effects were more dreaded than the disease itself. In 1932, a newer, safer version of the shot was introduced throughout the United States and beyond. Although it contained a new ingredient intended to make the shot more effective, the addition may have forever altered the history of medicine and human health as we know it. Within a year of the introduction of this new shot, the health landscape began a significant shift, and all over the country, toddlers, mostly boys, began to experience a unique change in their mental faculties, a transformation which would later be called autism.